So as we get started, I'd like to invite you to kind of take a minute and think about someone that you really admire, someone you think is really amazing. And I'd like to kind of narrow that down a little bit. You know, sometimes we're tempted to think that because someone is very powerful or very wealthy, that there's someone worth admiring. You know, we might think that, well, because someone's famous, they'd be great to admire. And there's certainly nothing wrong with those things, but I think the most admirable people are people who kind of live life kind of different. People who kind of somehow have learned to understand how to live outside the noise of life, that as they're in a situation and as things are blowing up all around them or as things are not going the way they want them to, somehow they still have this confidence that God's in control, and they don't lose sight of that fact. That they don't lose sight of the fact that we never really have control over our lives. We have control over our decisions. We have control over our responses. But the reality is that most of life we don't have control over. You know, and I certainly resist that reality a great deal. And I think many of us do. But somehow there are other people who don't. And so often these people are people who, they seem to enjoy life in a different sort of way, that they seem to have this kind of sense of wellness about them, not arrogance, but a sense of wellness, and that as much as they're enjoying life and as much as they might have a sense of confidence in themselves, they're also incredibly loving towards other people, that there's a person who seems to invest in others more, who actually makes it a point of making a difference in other people's lives. And I'll be honest, I have not known many people who really kind of pull that off. I've kind of known of some, but I haven't known many people who can really pull that off. I certainly don't always pull that off. But I believe that sort of lifestyle is in reach for all of us. I believe that is something that we can all do. But it's not going to happen by accident. It's going to require that we intentionally try to do it. So the question is, how do we do that? So with that in mind, I want to kick off a new series today that I've called Follower. Now, you know, not the most powerful title I could come up with. I don't think most of us woke up this morning going, you know what I want to be today? I want to be a follower. We often want to be a leader. We want to be independent. I want to do what I want to do. But being a follower is not always bad, not when the example is a good one. Because what did Jesus call his disciples and apostles to do? What does he call us to do? To follow him. To follow him. And what does follow mean when it comes to Jesus? It means to do what we see him do, to live the way we saw him live. Right? So that if you look at the way Jesus interacted with people, he literally lived outside the noise. No matter what was going on around him, he just didn't let it decide what he was going to do. That he had a real sense of purpose, a real sense of direction, and he walked that out. He lived that out in his life. And he invited others to follow. He invites us to follow. So what I'd like to do as we kind of go through this series is kind of look at what we see Jesus do and see how we can apply it. Right? Because if you look at what Jesus did, he lived a life of love. But what's interesting is that he lived a life of love with purpose. You know, Jesus didn't run around just hugging everybody. Right? Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you. Not that that's a bad thing. But what Jesus did is he lived a life that pointed people towards God. And so he lived out this idea of love, and in love we speak truth, right? So he didn't always tell people what they wanted to hear. But what was really interesting is that the way Jesus told people truth, they generally didn't get offended by it. They were actually what we call convicted by it. And keep in mind that convicted is not a bad thing, right? There's a big difference between being convicted and condemned. Right, if I feel condemned, that means I feel put down, crushed. But if I'm convicted, that means that something moves me to recognize that maybe I'm not quite where I want to be. And then it becomes up to me to respond to that feeling. Do I justify my actions and move on? Or do I go, wow, that's not really who I want to be? And I make the decision to change that. And so speaking truth to someone who is doing something that's harming themselves or harming someone else, that is very consistent with love. right? That, you know, if someone has a habit that is self-destructive, they might need a hug, but they also need truth. And that's the kind of love that Jesus lived, and that's what we're called to do. And as I say speak truth, I mean that, I don't mean we walk up to people and start screaming in their face to change, right? Because Jesus earned the right to share that kind of truth, right? The way he interacted with people, the way he treated people, the way he was compassionate towards people, the way he seemed to give people time to kind of understand. Again, if you read through the Gospels, during that, you know, roughly 3 years that Jesus was with his apostles, they clearly weren't getting it. And he didn't lose patience with them. He calls them kind of daft a couple times, but you always kind of fear he's kind of fooling around about that a little bit. Like, come on, guys, don't you get it yet? He gave people patience. He was patient with people, gave them time. But when it became time, he spoke truth. And if you look at what Jesus did, you know, what did he do? He often would teach to people, but he also cared for people. He was part of their lives. He walked in life with them. And sometimes he also healed people. But the reality is he spent way more time caring for people and walking with people than healing people, at least as far as we can tell from the Gospels. So when Jesus says, follow me, that's what he's calling us to do, to be in people's lives. You know, there is, you know, teaching is important, right? That's why I do what I do. You know, and talking to one another kind of as peers about the truth of the gospel, right? That's important. But what's, if all you do is speak truth, no one will ever hear you. But if we take time to care for people, to be compassionate with people, to walk with people, to do things like Jesus did, we also get to be part of healing people. Now, we may not be able to walk up to people and physically heal them, but if someone's in a time of crisis, in a time of darkness in their life, if you're there and with them, you're part of healing them. And if we become aware of someone who has some kind of need, a financial need, a physical need, and we're able to meet that need, if we make the decision to meet the need, we're a part of healing. So Jesus really calls us to do the things he did, including healing people. But we don't do it through miracles, per se. We do it through presence, through action, through compassion. And so that's what it means to live as a follower of Jesus. And if we will do that, I believe that will change our individual lives. It will change the lives of those around us. It will change the life of our church. It will change the life of our community. If that's who we become, if that's who we decide to be, but we have to decide to be it and do it. And the thing is that sometimes treating people that way is not easy. I mean, if people are just like us or people we've been friends with for years, doing those things are a bit easier. But if people are different from us, I mean, what if someone looks differently than we do? Are we still okay with it? What if someone believes incredibly differently than we do? Are we still willing to invest in their lives? What if they act ways we don't agree with? What if they've made lifestyle choices that you don't agree with? Do you still want to help that person? Do you still want to invest in that person's life? What if they voted for the other party? They clearly must die. That's humor. Come on. I'm not that kind of church. Come on. That's a joke. Clearly, I delivered that too well. Okay. Right? The idea is, but it's a crazy time we live in, right? You know, that both parties, and some of you are going to vastly disagree with me on this, both parties can argue that they are for God. Right? Both parties can. One can argue that compassion is closer. Another's arguing that truth is closer. The reality is in the middle. There is no God party. Right? That Jesus is the God party. The rest of us have to live with imperfect parties and make our decisions based on where we feel is most close. And I'm not here to tell you which one that is. But as soon as we start disqualifying people because they vote differently than we do, or support issues differently than we do, I mean, you don't have to be their best friend, but we should be compassionate towards one another, and we should prioritize caring for people. But caring for people who are different than us can be hard. So where does Jesus come down on this? Where does Jesus tell us, or how does he tell us we should deal with people who are different than us? Because if you ever look at Jesus, the only people we have record of him getting angry at are who? Religious leaders who put people down. He was compassionate towards everyone else. He spoke truth, but with compassion. The only people he really gave a hard time to were religious leaders who were putting people down. So what I wanted to do today was actually walk through an encounter that Jesus has with a religious leader. And this encounter will actually lead to us going through one of the most famous parables that Jesus tells. Now, what is a parable, right? A parable is just a story with a point. It has a lesson built into it, kind of like a fable sort of thing. And so what happens here is we actually walk through this record of an encounter that Jesus has with a religious leader. And during that encounter, he tells a parable. So this is documented for us by the gospel writer Luke. So Luke tells us, one day an expert in religious law, I just scrolled my screen, sorry. I got excited and I knocked my screen. You know, paper doesn't do that, you will tell me, right? Yeah. Paper doesn't suddenly zoom in and scroll, right? So start again. One day an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question. Teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life? Now, to us, that seems like a fairly simple question. But remember that this is pre-New Testament. This is kind of Old Testament. They lived under the law. And one of the things that was common to do, because the law never really was super clear about do this and you will live sort of thing. It would have a lot of different rules, and there are a lot of different guidelines. And it was very popular among the religious leadership to debate just which of those things were the ones that kind of led to this idea of the kingdom of God. So what this religious leader is doing is he's trying to test Jesus. He's kind of like, well, you say you know so much about all this stuff. What do you say we have to do? And my guess is, we don't have absolute clarity on this, but my guess is that what the religious leader is trying to do is draw Jesus into a debate. Because that was very popular in the culture of the religious leaders to debate out points and argue from one side or the other. But the thing is that from all the records we have, anytime you try to test Jesus, you try to test his religious knowledge, his ability to deal with people, he seems to prevail every time. Because he kind of approaches things very differently. Right? Is that as the religious leader asked this question, his expectation would be that Jesus would give some kind of point-by-point breakdown of this is how you do it. But Jesus didn't do that. Generally speaking, when someone like a religious leader asked Jesus a question, Jesus would respond with another question. So basically, Jesus says to the guys, like, well, you're an expert. You know the law well. What do you say you should do to get into the kingdom of God? And Luke tells us that the man answered, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, this is actually a fantastic answer, because the Old Testament doesn't really break it down that succinctly. Generally, there are a list of rules. And what he's really done is he's actually summarized the Ten Commandments, because four of the commandments are about our relationship with God, six are about our relationship with other people. But he's also kind of really summarized what we call the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Right? That's kind of the books of Moses, they're sometimes called. And there was a whole bunch of discussion in there about how we interact with God and how we treat one another. And what the man has basically done is he's summarized Deuteronomy chapter 6, which is this whole list of things that you do in your interactions with God, and he summarized Leviticus chapter 19, which is all these things that we should or should not do to other people. And he's boiled that down to a really clear answer. And Jesus actually tells him that it's a great answer. He says, right, you've got it. You've got the knowledge. You have studied. I bet you went to Bible study on Wednesday nights. Do this, and you will live. Knowledge isn't enough. Knowledge isn't the point. Knowledge is important, but knowledge empowers us to do. One of the things that frustrated Jesus so much about the religious leadership in the first century is that knowledge had become the end goal. It was always about knowing more, debating better. Jesus said, that stuff's good. You should know. You should know what you're talking about. You should know what you're there to understand. But what matters is what you do. It's not about what you know. It's not about what you feel. It's not even just about what you believe. Yes, those things are important. But what is most important is what you do. Right? We've talked about this a bunch the past few weeks. In fact, it was kind of the core of my message last week, right? Was that what we do matters most. And, you know, we live in a time where it's very tempting. I mean, well, I should say throughout my lifetime, it has become, I think, increasingly tempting to know more and more. And I don't think we decide to do less. We just kind of tend not to do it. We don't sit back and go, I'm not going to do nothing, right? But we get very focused on knowledge and expanding knowledge. And we live in a time where YouTubers who are out there doing these point-by-point breakdowns of these really deep Old Testament verses and going way down deep where I would question how well they can back up some of what they're saying. And Jesus didn't go, you know, when you have YouTube, what I want you to do is debate the finer points of every Old Testament detail or every New Testament detail. I'm quite certain, I have no idea what he said about YouTube, but I can't imagine that's what he was hoping for, right? It's about a tool to reach people, to connect with people. Our job is to bring people life. And so he's saying to this religious leader, yes, you know all those things, now do it. But now, of course, you know, if we think of this idea as Jesus as the standard for how we treat one another, I'll just out myself. I do not do that all the time. That may be a shock to you, but I kind of doubt it. Right? That we all struggle with that. You know, like imagine, you know, if we talk about this idea of loving one another and loving people who are different from us. Have you ever been in traffic going along and somebody cuts you off and you're like, oh, I love that person who cut me off? You may have said something, but it probably wasn't that. And we can get really small about it too, right? We're in a hurry, we run to the grocery store, we pick up three items, we go to the 10 items or less line, and there's somebody there with a full cart in the line that they know they don't belong in. And we have an option. We can say, wow, that person may have something going on in their life where, yeah, they made this choice because they were just short on time and they just had to deal with this. Or do we just assume that you're just a jerk and they don't care about anybody else and they've ruined my day and they probably set out to ruin my day specifically by getting in this line? Right? We all struggle with that stuff, right? You know, and again, we live in this time, I kind of opened with this, but this idea of just one political party is the party of God and the other party is evil. Neither one's true. Right? Neither one gets it right. You got to pick one. Pick one. I do believe you should vote. You should support issues that are important to you. You should fight for issues that are really important to you. But do not delude yourself that one of those parties is on the side of God. They get some things right. They get some things wrong. You know why? Because they're just like all of us. I get some things right. I get some things wrong. We all do. So as long as it's people, that's going to be the case. Now, for this religious leader, Jesus has kind of called him out, right? That you know what you're supposed to do, but you're not doing it. That's the implied text here. You're not doing it. You're certainly not doing it as widely as I have called you to. For example, Leviticus 19 actually says, be kind to the foreigner in your midst. Because when you were foreigners in Egypt, God loved you. And this gentleman would have certainly not had any respect for people who were not Jewish. So he says, Jesus saying, well, do you do this? So the man kind of feels put on the spot. So he makes a decision. Is he convicted or does he feel condemned? If we're convicted, we have a choice. We can justify our actions, or we can decide to make a change. Let's see what this gentleman says. The man wanted to justify his actions. So he asked Jesus, well, who is my neighbor? Because remember, the call is to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, who is my neighbor? My neighbors are people who are just like me, who believe what I believe, who think like me, who act like me, who vote like me. And what this guy is trying to do, right, is he's trying to narrow the scope, right, is that he's basically trying to say that, well, if I can narrow down the group of people that I'm supposed to actually love to a group of people small enough, then I can say I'm actually doing it. But Jesus kind of says you don't get to do that. Right? So what the man basically says then is that, well, who is my neighbor? In other words, who am I supposed to treat this way? And again, Jesus could have done a logical point-by-point breakdown of who this list includes. He could have certainly reminded this gentleman of what Leviticus chapter 19 says. But that would be a logical battle. And honestly, when you're dealing with an issue like this, logical fights rarely prevail. Right? Logical fights are just kind of back and forth. What really changes people's hearts, what changes our hearts, is connection. Right? It's an emotional issue. Right? When we treat someone poorly who's different than us, or even if it's not explicitly because they're different, but imagine if there's someone in your family who has difficulty doing something, and you love that person. When they have difficulty doing it, you're probably fairly patient with them because there's someone who's in your family and you care about them. If you're out somewhere and someone behaves kind of similarly but doesn't look like your family member and their actions aren't necessarily the same as your family members, but it has the same result, sometimes it's harder to be loving. They feel like they're delaying you, they're holding you back. And so when we think about this idea of loving one another, what Jesus calls us to do is to treat everyone the same across the board. Now, we can't do it perfectly, but we can try to do it better. Right? So as this gentleman asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? Jesus decides to paint a picture using a story so he can connect with emotion and he can create an example. So Jesus tells a parable. Luke tells us that Jesus replied with a story. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. Now, if you've been in church for any length of time, you have certainly heard this story, right? It's the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, you may have heard that, oh, they're traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. He's walking down a road. But the people who were there in the first century would have understood that differently. Because one of the things that would have very likely been going on, whenever one of the religious leaders encountered Jesus and started to argue with him, a crowd would gather around. They wanted to see how it was going to go. So by telling a story, Jesus actually starts to paint a picture that connects not just with the man he's talking to, but to everyone there. And that road from Jerusalem to Jericho is a 17-mile-long road that you would walk from one city to the next. And it was a very hilly road, a very winding road through the deserts. So if something happened to you on that road, your chances of survival were almost zero. You're well outside the city. It's a desert landscape. There are lots of hills and bends so that bandits can hide around corners and attack you with no notice that it's about to happen. So as Jesus says this, for the folks who were living there, this would have created an emotional connection. This would have created fear, knowing that this could happen to any one of them. So as Jesus describes that, he then says what the bandits did. The bandits stripped the man of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. Now remember that this is the first century, right? This is 2,000 years ago. No one's got a cell phone to call 911, right? That the police are not going to drive by. There's no emergency services in the area. If this man is left lying on a desert mountain road, you know, as much as 8 miles from each city, and no one does anything, he's going to die. And they all know that that could happen to them sometime. So Jesus sets that up and says, this is the situation the man's in. That unless someone chooses to get involved, unless someone chooses to get dirty, this man has no chance of survival. But then Jesus goes on to say, by chance a priest came along. But when the priest saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. He never even stopped. Now, why wouldn't he stop? What's the issue there? Well, he certainly would have known the rules about loving God and loving your neighbor, right? The priest is Jewish. This man here is Jewish. They may have both lived in the same neighborhood, for all we know. So he could have literally been his neighbor. But the priest was concerned about something else. A really big issue in the first century was this concept called being ceremonially clean. In other words, were you in a state or a condition where you were allowed to participate in the religious practices? And one of the things that made you unclean was that if you touched a person who was ill with certain diseases, or if you touched a dead body, that would make you unclean. So what that would mean for the priest, that if he got near this man and he had one of those diseases, or, you know, he died, the priest would now be ceremonially unclean. So he made the decision that the right answer was to leave the man there. So what choice did he make? He pulled out a scale effectively in his mind. And he said, are my religious practices more important, or is the life of this man more important? And he made the choice to say, my religious practices are more important. Right? Keep in mind that there were lots of priests. There was something he was supposed to do and he didn't show up, someone else would have done it. And even if no one else did, God would be fine with that. Right? Because caring for this person should have been more important. But at least according to that priest, his religious practices were more important. And then as the story continues, it says a temple assistant walked over and looked at the man lying there. So a temple assistant walks up. Now sometimes these are called Levites. You may know that term better depending on kind of what Bibles you use. But this is a person who would have also been deeply studied in the religious law. He would have known this love God, love neighbor thing. Now he does a little better. He actually walks up to the guy to see what's going on, but then he also passed by on the other side. So we don't really know what the issue there was. Was it kind of rubbernecking? Hey, let's see what's going on. My bet is what it probably was, is that I'm going to get a little closer. I'm going to assess the situation. If it's not too much trouble, I'll help him out. But wow, this is more trouble than I was banking on. So I'm going to go ahead and move on. So again, likely concerned about being ceremonially uncleaned, or at least concerned about being inconvenienced, that he would have had to interrupt his life to make a difference here, knowing what it meant for this man. Now, Jesus tells us then someone else comes along. And this is what the term you've probably heard since you were a kid, if you've been in church. Then a despised Samaritan came along. Now, despised Samaritan. Why were Samaritans despised? You know, when I was a kid, I thought Samaritans were like just really good people. But that's not what it means. A Samaritan was someone that the Jews looked at as heretics. That in their history, Samaritans had been Jewish, but somewhere along time, they kind of mixed with other cultures. Their religion changed a little bit. And so the first century religious leaders of the Jews actually saw Samaritans as people who had just totally gotten it wrong. And they actually kind of, I want to be very careful how I say this. They looked down on them. I just said, they looked down on them a great deal. They would have nothing to do with them. They thought that a Samaritan was someone you should have nothing at all to do with. And so you could almost imagine that as the crowd's there and Jesus says a Samaritan came along, you'd hear like boo, hiss, ooh. They would be expecting when they hear that, oh man, if the priest and the temple assistant did bad things, what is this guy going to do? And when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him. He saw what was happening there, and he did let it interrupt his life. He did let it move him to do something different. He did let it move him to make a change. That just as the Jewish people had looked down on the Samaritans, We don't have a lot of information about this, but in all likelihood, it seems almost definitely would be the case, Samaritans would have not liked Jewish people in general. But in this case, he felt compassion for him. And then the Samaritan did something the religious leaders wouldn't do. Going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oils and wine and bandaged them. He actually took care of the man. He looked at him, he saw what was going on, was moved by compassion, and he cares for him. And here's the thing. That Samaritan would have almost definitely known that had the tables been turned and the Samaritan was the one who was attacked, this man that he's caring for would not have stopped for him. He made the decision that even though this person would not do for me, I'm going to do for them anyway. That human compassion is more important than that. He knew how this man would have likely looked at him, knows the man would have ignored him, but he refused to do it. So as it interrupts his life, he decides to at least take care of the guy's immediate needs, but go beyond that, right? He says, then the Samaritan put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn where he took care of him. So he now, what is he doing? He's now doing what we're called to do. He's investing his time and his abilities, right? He had some basic knowledge on how to care for the guy. You know, getting him on the donkey, getting him to the inn, actually stopping and staying at the inn to care for the man took his time. And that's what we're called to do. As we are moved to compassion, as Jesus says, you know, do this and you will live, we're called to do. Give of our time. Give of our talents. And we can all do something. I know that we're in different stages of lives and some of us are older and, you know, carrying a body on a donkey is probably not what you're looking forward to doing, right? But we can all do something. You know, we can be in active prayer circles for one another, right? We can help out with things that aren't physical, right? But we can all do something. And if we have time, let's spend it on things that change lives, that make a difference in other people's lives. But sometimes our time and our abilities can't take care of everything. And that's ultimately the case with the Samaritan, is that at some point he does need to get back to his life. He does have things he needs to do. So what does he do? It says, the next day, the Samaritan handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, telling him, take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time I'm here. So he invested his time and his abilities. He also invested his resources, right? That there are always things going on in the world that you can't address directly, that I can't address directly. But if we have resources, even a small amount of resources, you know, donate the things that you believe matter. You know, if there are bigger international things that move your heart, support those things. You know, even a dollar makes a difference in many of these organizations. But also, look around where we live. Do you need to go international to find people who have needs? Right, the town we live in has lots of needs. You know, if you can give your time and ability, do that. If you give your resources, do that. That we are called, when Jesus says, do this, this is what he's talking about. That, you know, I firmly believe that every good thing in our lives is a gift from God. And if I believe that, that means that nothing I have is entirely my own. Right? That doesn't mean that I'm wasteful. You know, I own a home. You know, I invest in my retirement. I do those things. But it's also important to carve out part of our time, part of our abilities, part of our resources, to care for something that makes a difference. That's what we're called to do as Jesus followers. And it's not just a New Testament thing, right? Going back to the original 5 books that are in the Bible, that's what we're called to do. That's what makes a difference. And so Jesus, as he's talking to this religious leader, he says, I've told you this whole story. You've heard all these things. And you asked me, so who is my neighbor? So Jesus now says, well, now which of these 3 would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by bandits? The man says, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus drives it home again. Yes, now go and do the same. We are called to action. Our knowledge matters, right? We should know what we believe. We should understand what we believe. We should try to grow in that knowledge. But we should never let growing in our knowledge take the place of investing in people's lives. That if we do that, if we get so caught up in knowledge, we lose compassion for people. We don't mean to do it. It just happens. What grows compassion for people is being with people who need compassion. Right? Stepping out and being in people's lives. And as people struggle, be there for them. Make that kind of difference in life. And it only happens, I truly believe it only happens when we do it in three parts. Giving of our time, giving of our abilities, whatever they may be. Like, I've volunteered in the kitchen. I can't cook, but you know what I can do? I can wash pans. Kind of. I do my best. Right? I can carry things. I can wipe off a counter. I can ask where the eggs are. You know, sort of thing. But we can all do something. You know? Honestly, if you're at a point where physically you can't do something, then encourage people. Be the person who sits there and says, man, I am so glad you're here today. You know, and honestly, in the church, you know the biggest difference we can make is make it a point to welcome people who walk through the door. Right? I'm going to ask a question. My goal is not to condemn anyone. I'm going to be super clear about that. We had 53 people in the sanctuary last week, about 60% more than we normally have. 70% more. I just had to qualify that. 70% more than we normally have. Some of those people were brand new. Some of those people hadn't been here in a really long time. How many of them did you go up and say hi to? I am so glad you're here today. That is the simplest thing that any of us can do. I am so glad you're here today. My name is Jim. If you have any questions, let me know. Or hey, I'm just so glad you're here today. Right? When we have our cafe, how often do we ask someone we don't know to sit next to us? Someone we haven't seen in a while to sit next to us. We should be the most hospitable people there are. That no one should ever walk into a church and feel alone. Even if you don't know anyone. We can all do that. Because I really believe that living out this life like Jesus describes is like throwing pebbles in a pond. Just as you drop a pebble in a pond, that ring goes outward. We start with compassion for those who are in front of us. Especially making those who we don't know, who are new, feel welcome. And then we move out. We move out through our church. We move out through our town. We move out through the world. Using the things we have access to. Our time, our abilities, and our resources. Because we are called to be one family under God. And that's what we celebrate today as we celebrate communion. Right? That we come together as one family under God, caring for one another. And making sure that anyone who walks through that door knows we care for them. We make it a point to say hi to them. Make it a point to make sure they feel welcome. And in communion, we celebrate the fact that at some point, someone did that for us. It may have been your parents when they walked you through the door. You know, or it may have been like me when I'm in my 40s and I walk into a church for the first time in a really long time. And someone says, hi, I'm so glad you're here, which was not at all what I expected to hear. Because you know what? People who are struggling with God don't think you're glad that they're here. And we have to change that. And as we come together with communion, let's remember that we are one family celebrating that connection to one another and that connection to God.